Well, first up, actor Saoirse Ronan played Rona in The Outrun, a film set in Orkney off the northwest tip of Scotland and based on the book by Amy Liptrot. When I met Saoirse in September, we spoke about how demanding the role was, and I asked her if some scenes were traumatic, given that her character Rona has a serious problem with alcohol.
They are. I mean, I actually think there was only one scene that, I hate to use this word, but it did kind of trigger me, I suppose. I found it quite overwhelming. And it was the scene where myself and Papa Essiadu, who plays Dane and her partner in the film, they've just returned home and she's just ruined this very important night for him. And he starts to pour bottles of wine down the sink, and she just sort of goes into this really chaotic, hysterical, emotional state and becomes mean and this very kind of ugly version of herself. And I think sort of like physically and emotionally really having to go to that place in that scene definitely was something that I needed to step away from as soon as we'd finished with the take. I just needed a moment, and I don't really get that a lot when I'm working. So yeah, that was kind of overwhelming. But apart from that, it was a very sort of insightful and cathartic experience for me. It's why I wanted to do it. It's something, like many others, that has affected my life. It's the sort of confusion and frustration that comes with watching a loved one go through something like that, feeling like you're not enough, that you're not enough to change them, cracking that open when you're finally ready to, and understanding the psychology of a person like that who's suffering from that illness was something that I personally needed. And so I'm incredibly grateful to the film for that.
And obviously, when you say it's personal, obviously it's so personal. You don't talk about why it's so personal, do you?
I mean, like anyone, I have people close to me who have suffered from this addiction in particular. And, you know, some of whom have come out the other side and are in recovery, and some who aren't. And that's painful, regardless of what side of it you're on, you know. And we've seen the response to the movie. It's been so kind of widespread, and it already seems to feel so universal. And like it's actually, which I hadn't thought about at the time. We had a screening the other night, and there were people of all different ages there, and every single one of them connected to it, because they either had a child who was suffering from addiction, they had gone through it themselves or are going through it, they had a partner who had gone through it. You know, I feel like there's no specific demographic for this movie. It's so universal. Alcohol, as a substance in particular, is so ingrained in our culture. It's everywhere. And that was an incredibly enlightening thing when I started to actually re-examine how much that's a part of our everyday life and how dependent, reliant we all are on it, even if we're not addicted to it.
It's nice though, because it ends on a hopeful note. In
it
other
really
words,
does.
It's like it's a tough watch, but it's not bleak because it ends up positive.
It's really not. And like, we're very hesitant to brand it as an addiction movie. It's a recovery movie. You know, there is probably a quarter of the film where we watch Rona at her absolute worst, but then the rest of it is about her trudging on. It's about her taking it day by day. At some points it's harder than others, but for me, even as an audience member watching it, this movie ultimately is about those brief moments of joy and lightness that we all kind of live for, that Rona finds and that also the people around her find, you know, in spite of the hardship that they've had.
Is it true that it was your husband Jack who originally gave you Amy Liptrot's book?
Yes, he is a very proud Scotsman, and so he was always fascinated with the Orkney Islands. He had travelled there a few years before, and whenever he goes to a new place, he always tries to find, in particular, a piece of fiction from that place, or an author who had come from that place. And so The Outrun had been on our bookshelf for years, and during lockdown he finally read it, and as soon as he finished it he handed it to me and he said, this is the next role that you have to play. And so I read it straight away, and I agreed with him. And I think apart from the personal reasons that I wanted to delve into a topic like this, also from a performance perspective, it was allowing me to explore things that I had never been able to with a performance before. Because I was playing someone who was under the influence, it meant that their judgment so often was so clouded that I could make the performance as big, as small, as ridiculous, as funny, as heartbreaking, as beautiful, as ugly as I wanted it to be, because for a large section of the movie, I'm not in my right mind. So actually, I don't want this to sound insensitive, but it is kind of a gift as an actor to be given a role like that where you can kind of go anywhere with it.
A gift indeed. Saoirse Ronan speaking to me about The Outrun. Now, comedian Tommy Tiernan covered a lot of ground in his interview with me, from relationships with his father and mother, how he felt when he first met his wife Yvonne, how his two dogs have totally different personalities to each other, and how he seriously considered becoming a priest.
I think if you were back in those days, I think I met a fella. I was in the Vatican.
Would you have recently?
I was in the Vatican, and
as you are,
it's a great place to be a gay priest. It is a great place to be a gay priest. Most of the art is homoerotic. It's a lot of semi-naked men, muscles and sheets draped around their productive regions. And a lot of people would have joined the priesthood in the 50s and 60s and 70s, fellas who were gay maybe, and they said, if I join the priesthood, I'm not going to have to answer the question, how come you're not married? That question would no longer be asked of me. And if you're good at poetry as well, you had to, that's half religious anyway. So, and I think that, how did I get onto this particular, we don't know. Anyway, so I'll keep going and see where we end up. So I was in the Vatican and I was I would say that my Catholicism or my love of the Christian story received a big boost. You know, it's the art is magnificent. The intention of Catholicism is gorgeous. Do unto others as you would do unto me, insomuch as you did it to the least of my brothers, you did it to me. Love one another as I have loved you. The intentions of that are so gorgeous. So when I was about... we had no religion in our house growing up. A nun nor priest never darkened the door. We weren't made go to mass or any of that type of stuff. And then when I was about 14 or 15, I just thought it was a radical alternative to what was being proposed to me by the education system. I thought, wow, this is different because it's offering a kind of moneyless life. A love life. And I thought that was incredible. And then I got into the Water Boys and stuff like that. And it was, that was very spiritual as well. And you too were kind of spiritual back then. And so I went to join the Redemptorist priests and I got talking to this fella. I can see him in my mind's eye now. God knows what has happened to him. He had rosy red cheeks, like somebody from Kilchamah or Cross Malina. Do you know, they're kind of soft.
Yeah, lovely, kind of, like, healthy.
But a kind of dark black hair, pure white skin and rosy kind of red cheeks and ruby red lips. And he was about 19 or 20 years of age. And we just got talking one afternoon and he says to me, I have a devotion towards Our Lady. And I just said, I have to get out of here because I have no idea what that young fella's talking about. And in many ways, I still don't. But I knew that I knew myself and himself didn't belong in the same organisation. So for someone of 19 years of age in 1989 to say to me, I have a special devotion towards Our Lady. I just had no comprehension of what that meant. So I left.
That's so interesting, though. A, that you thought about it and B, that you left. You're still pretty spiritual today, though, aren't you? I mean, I know you've spoken about going to the Vatican, but it was an amazing experience to go there.
Yeah, it was, but I wouldn't say I'm any more spiritual or religious than anybody else. I think we all carry this, just that my imagination drifts there more often, maybe. And I love books about Jesus. I love them. And I love the stories of the Bible, and I love kind of hipster theology. I'm very, I wouldn't be able to go to Maynooth and get a degree now, but I'd sit in the Pepper Pot Cafe and talk about how God's presence also contains his absence. Like, I'd knock 10 minutes out of that. But I think we all have it.
Mm.
You know, we all have something, whether it's a hope or... I shouldn't even be trying to describe what I think other people have. It comes very natural to me to be interested in religion.
The inimitable Tommy Tiernan. And all the details of Tommy's live shows are on his website, tommytiernan.ie. Next up, musician Sharon Corr spoke to me last April about the Corr's tour, about her life in Spain and her wonderful parents. And during our conversation, she remembered a shopping trip with her sisters to Harvey Nicks in London.
Our house, our actual family home, was perfect, and Mum and Dad kept it great. Jim had his rented, what was it, lodge at the end of, you know, like a farm or whatever. And it was just riddled in damp and spiders. And, you know, we had the egg cartons on the wall for soundproofing. I mean, it was as basic as you get. Manky. But, you know, then cut to maybe 1998, 1999. It's Christmas time. We're never out of London. We're never out. We're just touring the world. We're playing like Wembley Arena six times in a row. And it's like, you know, it's like mind-boggling. We were staying in the Mandarin Oriental in Knightsbridge, which is, again, it's like, hello, we're from Dundalk. And then I remember, you know, coming out of the Mandarin Oriental in London, and we never stopped working. So we had a day off, and we were going in to buy Mum and Dad their Christmas presents. And I don't think I'd been in Harvey Nicks before. I mean, we did, and everybody recognised us. And we were like, oh my God, this is mortifying. And then I remember buying Mom this like beautiful Donna Karan velvet sort of top and skirt for Christmas, because this was the Christmas where we've treated them, you know, and just to be able to afford that stuff was greatly appreciated, unnecessary, but lovely to do for our parents. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that sort
really
of thing
is.
Was
like
lovely.
Giving back to them.
It is, yeah.
And when you think back on those amazing days, you say like 6 days in a row at Wembley, and you are back together again now, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy it more now than in the huge days or not? Is it different?
I think that I know personally I'm much more comfortable in my skin. I have a lot more confidence as an older woman, and I'm very proud of being an older woman. You know, in my 50s, 50s have been the best years of my life, I have to say. I think that there were so many times that I really enjoyed in the earlier days, but we didn't. Like, I remember saying to Andrea specifically the first day in Wembley Arena, I remember saying, I went up to her on stage and we were doing soundcheck. We were terrified. We were like deer in the headlights, you know? And I said to her, pinch yourself so you can remember this.
That was Sharon Corr speaking to me last April. Now let's jump to November, and Sunday Independent columnist Melanie Finn told me all about finding out that she had a colloid cyst in her brain. A mother of three young sons, she had collapsed a couple of times, leading to scans and a diagnosis and urgent surgery. I asked her how she felt before going into the theatre.
Terrified. Absolutely terrified. So they explain it to you in, you know, bald terms, your part of your head is shaved. Then they basically saw, you know, your skull. They take a piece of the bone flap out of your skull and then start at the procedure. So it would be from, you know, 4 to 5 hours. It's so probably one of the most complex, if not the most complex, surgeries anyone can perform. And complete awe of Professor O'Brien and his team, how they can even do this. And I believe it's not something that they could even do until a few decades ago, you know, when the rate, survival rate of brain surgery, you know, a century ago was about 50%. You know, so thankfully the odds and the technology has improved so much more in the meantime. But I have to say, I've never been more terrified my entire life. And you can do all the meditative thoughts you want and your yoga breaths. Sometimes you just have to admit you're absolutely petrified and sit in your feelings and feel your heart racing like it's going to come out of your mouth practically with the terror. And I remember one student nurse sitting with me, and it was about, I think it was about 6 a.m. and it's a really quiet place, the Richmond ward, you know, it's for people with severe neurological conditions, so no one's like bantering, so to speak. She just sat and she just held my hand. She was called Emma, and she said, you know, you're here because you're a fighter. You knew something was wrong, you felt it was wrong, and you got it checked out, and that's why you're here, and you're going to get better. And sometimes that's all you need to hear, you know. And I just felt, even though I was terrified, it was in the right place and everything was going to be fine. Even if I didn't know that was the case, I was going to tell myself that was the case. That was going to be my mind message. I was going to be fine. I was going to survive. And I was going to go home to my three boys and my husband.
When you woke up from the operation, can you remember that moment? Can you remember what you thought?
When I woke up from the surgery, I remember thinking I was going to feel this kind of Hollywood style wave of relief, you know, like a euphoria, like, oh, I did it. I survived brain surgery. Aren't I great? It's all over. And I didn't. I felt so overwhelmed. I felt like I was a stranger in my own brain. It's the only way I can describe it. I felt like I'd been run over by a bus. But the first face I saw was my lovely husband's. And I recognized him and he was there. And I was like, OK, I'm through that. I recognize him. And as far as I can tell, things are more or less, you know, the same. That's what I felt. But it was a far longer road to recovery than I thought it would be. I suppose, yeah, that's what I'd like to say is also, like, people might think now, like, oh, sure, she bounced back, or look at her now. Wasn't that, you know, an easy road? It was like, this is what, like 16 months after all that, it was horrendously long. And I suppose in terms of the recovery, like, brain surgery is very nuanced, and you do the most recovery in the first 6 months. And then after that, it's so tiny, the gains are so small. And also, if you had a broken leg and you had a cast, people would instantly know, oh, you're recovering, you're not well. Mm-hmm. Whereas this was all invisible. So people maybe wouldn't understand, like, why I was hesitating, or why I looked confused, or why was I so tired, or, you know, why wasn't I functioning like I had before? And it's because it's all invisible.
That was Sunday Independent journalist Melanie Finn. We're going to take a break.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Travel Department. Experience travel the way it's meant to be. Fully guided and extraordinary.
Tweet at Miriam O'Call.
Welcome back. Singer Rod Stewart, well, he's a frequent visitor to Dublin. I really enjoyed speaking to him before his concert in the Royal Hospital Kilmainham, when he talked about his Scottish roots, his love of football, his start in music, and some of his greatest hits, including his first one, Maggie May.
Yeah, Maggie May was the first one. It was actually a B-side. It wasn't even supposed to be on the album. That's how much the music people know. But they said, we've only got 8 or 9 tracks, we need one more. And I said, oh, I've got this one floating around that I haven't put any words to. Although I did have the opening line of Wake Up Maggie. I hadn't had a chance to finish it. So when I presented it to the record company, they said, well, this is no good. It hasn't got a bridge or a middle eight or anything people can sing. And they said, OK, well, we'll put it on anyway. And so it was the B-side of Reason to Believe. And a disc jockey in Cleveland turned it over, God bless him, and the rest is history, as they say.
At how big it became, Rod?
Oh, absolutely. You know, those days, you know, you didn't go into a studio to make hit records. You went in to make a complete album like a book and tell as many stories. One didn't look at the, you know, the top 10, or I never did anyway. Mm. I just wanted to make an album.
Did it change your life completely?
Oh, yes, it certainly did. In every way possible that's good. It's given me a wonderful life and wonderful kids, and I can do a lot for charity now, which I do, and I'm absolutely enjoying life.
That was Rod Stewart. He's such a lovely, generous interviewee. Well, Dublin author Christine Dwyer Hickey was in studio in September to tell me about her beautifully observed novel Our London Lives and about placing her characters, Millie and Pip, in a London she knew well. She even worked in the same pub as Millie did.
The outside of the pub is the same. It's completely changed inside. And it was a great experience at the time. And I spoofed my way into the job too. I'd spent enough time in pubs, Miriam, to know that there was, a certain way to pull a pint. And from the time I was a child, I was always behind the bar, running around behind the bars. And the thing is that I sort of thought, went in, and they don't do any of that, of course. You can just walk in and get the job there. Whereas here it was like a vocation. People had to do their time and they had to get their papers and they had to do all this. So anyway, I chanced my arm and I got the job. Really, I was looking for the accommodation to go with it. And so my room was like the room that Millie has. And my view out the windows, the little garret windows at the top, was the same. And the place at the time was very lively. It was very, very lively. It was real East End. But at the same time, there was a kind of an artistic touch to it too, and an intellectual touch, because all the newspapers are in the area. They're all since gone now, you know.
And you know, yourself and Dennis, you spent time in London, didn't you, to reacquaint yourselves with the places you were writing about?
Yeah, I have to get the location. If I don't get the location right, there's no point. I'm only guessing. And that's why we know I'll never write a novel set on the moon. I have to be able to be there. You know, I have to be there. But anyway, all I had was the notion of London, the idea of what the workers would do. What Minnie would do, what their job would be. Greatly exaggerated what I had in my head to my husband to get him to go with me. And found a flat. And we had a great time. We had a ball for 4 months. We did 3 months in Bayswater and a month in Notting Hill. I didn't work when I was there. I was just to soak up London life, to get the rhythm of the city, to get to understand how it worked, what it would be like to live there rather than to be a tourist.
And one thing I always notice in your characters, Christine, is all their flaws and all their insecurities. We all have them. But you get right into their heads, and we know what makes them nervous. So are they their thoughts or your thoughts?
They're theirs, I think. And it's my guessing of their thoughts, I think. Like when I was young and kind of thinking about being a writer, I remember accidentally, it's a big long story, I won't go into it, but accidentally reading Ulysses because I thought I was reading Strumpet City. And I was kind of, I liked it in the beginning even. I didn't get it, but I liked it. And then when I got to Leopold Bloom, the chapter with him, I got him straight away. And then a few pages later, I realised, I'm in this fella's head. I'm actually inside his head. And I'm seeing the streets through his mind. And I'm actually, he's talking to people and they don't know what he's thinking, but I know what he's thinking about, only in his head. And that's the only way that this story is being told, through his point of view. And I said to myself, if I ever be a writer, that's what the way I'm going to do it. So that's how I do it. I get inside their head, stay there, imagine I become them. It's a bit like method acting. And become them and just only see, hear and feel what they would see, hear and feel.
It really works. So, and of course, a big part of Pip's character is his alcoholism, his addiction.
Yeah,
that's a topic, Christine, of course, you've dealt with before. Many of my listeners will have read your book, Tatty, which gives the child's viewpoint. But this time you're telling it from the drinker's perspective.
Yeah, I kind of feel I wanted to understand the disease of alcoholism more, what it was like to be an alcoholic. And I have Pip and he's going through the recovery and he's really trying to make an effort to do it this time. And he goes to his AA meetings and he kind of hates them, and he hates listening to people's stories, and he's resisting everything. But it's a very hard life for him and a very lonely life, because the pub has propped him up. And he kind of thinks about, well, what do you do with yourself all day? He's 60 years of age, because it's divided into two sections. The first section is the past in 1979, and the alternate chapters. And when we meet him, he's 60 and he's just out of rehab again, but he's been in a long time this time. And so gradually they cross, as you said in your introduction, and they come together at the end. But he is very lonely. It's too late for him to really get a career. It's too late for him to do anything. He's relying on his brother, who's pretty well off and has got a life of his own, a successful life as a conductor and a musician. And it's just how lonely and difficult that life is. And I just wanted to understand how it felt like, because up to that, I was always looking at it from the perspective of the people who were affected by alcoholics.
Which, of course, you were.
Yes, I was.
Christine Dwyer Hickey speaking to me on publication of Our London Lives. Now, our wonderful newsroom colleague Charlie Burr died in March of last year. 2 months later, his widow Claire came in to speak to me, and she brought Tiger the dog with her. She talked to me about Charlie's last project, a film called Ransom 79, and their life before and after his diagnosis of motor neurone disease.
It was just, you know, we had a great life. And, you know, I'm so sad that, you know, when that all kind of stopped, when Charlie couldn't really walk anymore, we kind of stopped our hikes and our walks and all the rest. But yeah, no, we had an amazing life, Miriam. You know, he was very competitive. You know, we used to cycle around Wicklow. We'd do a 50K cycle. And if I only hit 49, he would still do the extra K just to show that he did 50 and I did 49. Everything was very competitive with him. But yeah. No, we had a brilliant life together. And I think it was just our interest in, you know, nature and walking and swimming. He used to love the 40 foot. We'd go down there and Bird would jump in for about 2 seconds, scream, get back out again. But yeah, he was a brilliant, brilliant character. And yeah, I really miss that. You know, when Charlie got M&D, it just... all that changed, you know, and even though he always tried to be upbeat, it just, yeah, I think M&D kind of won in the end.
You always called him Bird, didn't you?
Well, see, my maiden name is Mould. So when he met me, he was like, that is the worst name ever. So our wedding invite was Bird and Mould are getting married. And that's, I've always called him Bird. And I must call him Charlie. I've always called him Bird. And he's always called me Mould. Yeah.
Now, MND, as you say, motor neurone disease, did you notice anything first before even Charlie noticed?
No, because I kind of thought sometimes he was a bit of a hypochondriac, so I didn't 100% really believe that there was anything serious going on. And actually, Charlie, unfortunately, he died 3 years to the day. So he got his first symptoms. It was Paddy's Day. And he was kind of slightly choking on a sandwich, and he knew there was something wrong. And you know your own body, Miriam. Like, you know, you could be saying, I feel like this, but you need to listen to someone when they say, I'm not feeling 100%. And it kind of kicked off from there. And so Charlie was doing a series of podcasts, and he was doing them for the Senior Times. And one of them was about Ransom 79. But he noticed, and I noticed, that his voice was beginning to sound a little bit off. And if you listen to the podcast that he did, you can hear it. And he knew, but he went to so many specialists and they didn't quite know what was going on until we went to Orla Hardiman, who was an amazing lady. And she diagnosed him immediately and said, you have M&D. And it was the worst news we could ever hear. And she said, you have 2 to 3 years. And I thought, this is just absolutely dreadful that somebody would say that to you. But, you know, they prepare you. And I ended up having an amazing, as a Bird, relationship with Orla and her right-hand lady, Bernie Corr, who was the M&D nurse. And I still have phone calls with Bernie. She is so supportive. She actually said when Charlie died, we used to go to this clinic on a Thursday. Everybody in the clinic, all the patients, they were just so distraught because in their world, Charlie gave them hope. And I think they treated him differently, even though he had the same disease. He had M&D. He was as fragile and frail as anybody else. You know, when Charlie died, it really affected them. And Bernie rang me and said, you know, Claire, they can't believe it, that this man that gave them hope, you know, has died. He's exactly the same as everybody else. So, yeah, it was, yeah, pretty traumatic. You know, it's a dreadful disease.
Absolutely dreadful. You know, when you said Orla Hardiman, who is an amazing woman,
brilliant,
extraordinary, when you got that diagnosis, I mean, when you went home, like, how did you...
bawled all the way home. Bawled all the way. And then we rang Charlie's daughters, Orla and Nessa, who have been amazing to me.
Amazing.
I mean, the support all the way through, they've been fantastic. And I'm sure I annoyed them along the way by not getting carers in and doing it all myself, but they have been so fantastic. But we rang them and, yeah, just devastated because we had Googled M&D, and you know, it's we knew what was coming down the line, but I was always a little bit in denial, Miriam. And I used to say, no, Bird, you're going to be fine. You won't end up, you know, not being able to walk. You'll be fine. Everything was like, you'll be fine. But I'm sure I annoyed Charlie by saying it, but he could feel his body was just getting more and more fatigued. So he was a real trooper, Miriam, you know. But it's hard looking after someone when they're, you know, terminally ill. It's a 24-hour job, you know. So I work here in RTE, but I kind of stopped working, you know, with all the stress of it, but also to look after Charlie. And I think Ransom 79 worked because I understand production, I work as a producer. If I didn't, I don't think I would have been able to look after Charlie and also get him out to the shoots and make sure that he was okay. So yeah, he was brilliant to look after. He never complained. I have to say, he really didn't. He was amazing. Like, it was very difficult for him, and he was very honest about how he was feeling. We would sit down every day and I'd say, how do you feel today? And then he'd say, like, dreadful. And, you know, eventually I was like, I don't think I'll ask him how he feels every day, you know, just try and make him feel a bit more positive. So working, doing Ransom, doing any of the charity work was amazing for him. He would turn into a different bird being out there. You know, kept him going. One of the lines actually in the documentary, I think Colin Murphy says, how does this make you feel working on the dock? And he said, it keeps me alive. Mm-hmm. And it did. Kept him alive. Kept him busy.
The wonderful Claire Bird speaking to me about Charlie's life and work. We'll be back with more after this break.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Travel Department. Experience travel the way it's meant to be. Fully guided and extraordinary.
Tweet at Miriam O'Call.
Welcome back. I want to bring you part of a conversation now that I had with the incredible Geraldine Finucane. In February 1989, Geraldine's husband, Michael, a human rights lawyer, was killed in their home by loyalist paramilitaries, and Geraldine was injured herself that day too. In September of last year, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Hilary Benn, finally announced a full inquiry into the killing of Pat Finucane. And here Geraldine tells me about that day in 1989 and how she continued on in the immediate aftermath.
Well, I had a lot of support from my family and Pat's family. And really, they just ushered me along. And they made decisions, you know. They always asked me, do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? But really, they took over and sort of organised the wake and the funeral and stuff like that, because I just wasn't, I wouldn't have been able to do it on my own. But the support was there, and that's how I got through.
And the three children, Michael, John, Catherine, they were very young, weren't they? How old were they?
Michael was 17. No, 17. Yeah, Catherine was 12 and John was just short of 9. He was 8 when it happened.
And then how did you, in the coming, I suppose, weeks, try to explain all of this to your children? Or do you?
I mean, I probably was in a haze for between 2 and 3 years, really. I mean, I functioned. But like, it took me a long time to sort of gather and get a bit of strength back in me. So the support I had was what got me through.
And after a while, were you mainly angry? I often wonder this about what happened. Full of rage, or were you just incredibly sad that you'd lost your Pat?
I'd say I'm more angry now than I was then because of what I now know. For example, one of the many reports that was done, Pat's life was under threat for the third time in late 1988, and then he was killed in 89. But there was imminent danger twice before that, and we were never informed. Pat was never informed that his life was in imminent danger. Otherwise, we would have been conducting a totally different lifestyle. Mm-hmm. We would have been more security conscious. So That's why I'm more angry now, because it could have been prevented. Pat could still be here. I think for the first number of years, it was just shock, and there were questions that needed asked. So we just started asking questions, and information came out very slowly. So you had sort of a normal life, and then you'd get some information, and, you know, so it took some time for the whole thing to gather momentum.
You stayed in that house, which I find interesting. Why did you do that?
We weren't long in that house, and this was going to be our family home. And I have a bit of a stubborn streak. others might explain it in a different manner. But we had only just got that house, and I thought, well, I'm not giving up this house. You've wrecked my life, but, you know, I'm just going to stay here.
And that was Geraldine Finucane, an extraordinary woman. Now, jockey Davy Russell spoke to me about his autobiography, and we chatted about his style as a jockey and what he marks down to gut instinct.
Yeah, I'm not, and I never was very good at taking direction, or maybe if something was mapped out in front of me, I wasn't the best at following it. It's an amazing thing with horses. Obviously, there's no verbal connection between you, and it's all feel. So everything you feel, you do on a horse, you do it through a feel that the horse is giving you. And all my life, that's the only way I ever rode. I rode through the feel I was getting, and I used to change things. I never really made up much of a plan before a race. You know, there's an outlight plan. You do your homework, you study your opposition, you know, ground conditions, weight, distance, all of that. I that's easy enough for me. But as the race is run, I used to just kind of take it furlong by furlong or fence by fence, and just used to go on feel the whole time.
And actually, at one point, to that point there, you describe yourself as a passenger, but like, to what extent does the horse know what's expected of it? I mean, surely you're way more than a passenger.
Not really. You must understand they're bred and trained to do this specific thing, and they actually really enjoy it. And, you know, there's different areas in equine, you know, the show jumping, cross country, racing, you know, any number of hunting, every number of sections to it. But race horses love to run and jump, or just run, let it be the flat. And the jockey's part to play in that is to control that energy that they have, whether you need to motivate them through that or regulate it through slowing them down. And I suppose as a jockey, you just has to learn that. And what you kind of have to do is you have to put huge trust in the horse, and you have to kind of just be as at one with him, and not to interfere. The less you do on their backs, the easier it is for them to do what they love doing.
Jockey Davy Russell there. Now, playwright Marina Carr talked to me about her play in the Abbey Theatre last year called Audrey or Sorrow. We chatted about her work, The Pull of the Sea, and about how important she thinks it is to think and write about mystery.
I do believe that. And, you know, you look at any of the big religions of the world, they're all around mystery. And they're all about the other world, or the next world, and the last world. And so the idea of, you know, that we live in the four dimensions, you know, time, space, width, length. And then you think about time. And, you know, Blake said time is merely a construct of the fallen world, meaning us, and therefore to be treated with the greatest suspicion. So to play with time on stage is wonderful freedom, because there is a lot of playing with time in this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Explain a bit more to me about ghosts and the relationship with the other world. Do you believe in ghosts, or is it more of a dramatic device to tell a story?
I believe in them. I believe in them as presences, as emanations. I believe in them the way I believe in mystery. Things that can't be proven rationally, but things like the imagination, you know, ideas that come, or images that come, like dreams, like things that happen. I think most people of a certain vintage will say there are things that happened in their lives that for the life of them they cannot explain. So yes, I do. I do believe. I believe in them, but not like the ooh, you know, with the sheet over their head. Not like that. But the idea of an energy, a presence, an essence, and people who've gone, people you've loved who've gone before you, and the idea of them trying to maybe, you know, bless you or honour you or look after you in some way.
Mind you.
Yeah, I believe all that kind of thing.
I like that, actually. Yeah. I like that thought. You also don't shy away ever, Marina, from stuff that can be uncomfortable for an audience. Sometimes it's rage. Sometimes it's violence. Sometimes it's the truly awful things that happen again and again to us. There are tough themes in this play.
Yeah, there are tough themes. Well, the world is light and dark, you know. And we are capable, you only have to open a newspaper to realise what we are capable of doing to each other as the human race. So these things, you can't ignore these, they seep in. I think there's a lot of fear, a lot of threat and a lot of sorrow in the world right now, a lot of suffering. So you can't ignore that. So of course that seeps into the work and you have to let it in.
You always though usually manage to bring black humour. Do you do that here as well?
Yeah, you know, I've never actually tried to be funny because if I did, I'd fall flat on my face.
Yeah, but you are.
But it comes. If it comes, it comes. It should come naturally. And if it does, I'm delighted if it does. But think then again, I never know because things I find hilarious, other people don't. So, you know, it's a question of taste and one's own humour.
Playwright Marina Carr there. And speaking of humour, well, comedian Neil Delamere was on the programme chatting about his countrywide tour, his appearance on The Chase, his love of quiz shows and how it all started for him in comedy.
Well, people forget, I suppose, that there is no, like there was no comedy clubs, there was no YouTube and there was no, so how do you get exposed to it? So people like John Kenny, God rest his soul, John Kenny and Pat were going around, I remember seeing them in Vicar Street and being blown away. Because there were also other cultures, you know, so you were exposed to it. The only stand-up on TV was, and this was formative as well. The only other stand-up on TV was the stand-up show, which was on BBC One late at night. And Ardal hosted it, and then Tommy hosted it. And suddenly these are other lads who kind of look like you and sound like you, and you go, and something kind of ticks off in your brain, but you're only 15 or 16.
Yeah.
So I did it as a dare kind of in college and then just loved it and just wanted to do it a little bit. And then I kind of just took off from there.
Wasn't it in 2004 it took off? Well, you were on The Late Late with Pat Kenny, I think.
Yeah.
You went to Edinburgh for the first time.
Yeah.
Do you remember that Late Late? And do you remember
The Late Late? Yeah, it's there somewhere. Like, we didn't realise quite how big The Late Late or how scary it would be to do comedy in The Late Late, I suppose. Yeah. And there's a bit in the middle of it where, like, I'm 21 and I blank. But it was going well. And I said to the audience, you all enjoying yourselves? And they go, eh. And I go, good. And then by the time they'd say good, I'd remember the next line. But if you look at it, there's like blind panic in my face. And but yeah, we won a competition. And in that stage, they gave you a couple of quid to spend on equipment. And I thought, this will pay my rent for a little bit. And I might just kind of take a little time out, little hiatus from my job. I was a software engineer, a computer programmer, and just never looked back, really.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
And was Edinburgh important?
It was, yeah. Man, the early days in Edinburgh. Oh, my God. People ask you, do many people go? Nobody goes. Like, the average audience in Edinburgh is four people. So I'll never forget the first year I did it, my agent handed me a box of chocolates for getting through the run in Edinburgh. And I gave a chocolate to every member of the audience that night and didn't get through to the second layer of the box of chocolates.
That is so
cool. Like, there was no, people didn't go, they hadn't heard of you. And you just kind of slowly build it and, you know, you earn your chops, really, you know.
That is so good. And, you know, the kind of jokes and stories you told then.
Yeah.
Do you do them now? Or has anything changed much?
I mean, I do a lot of kind of topical stuff in the north in particular, and that's very handy because nothing changes. Sadly, you know, Stormont goes in, Stormont comes out, there's extremes on both sides, so you know, you can kind of, that's very good for comedy because it's very easy to mock stuff. I think there's universal things that, so when you're doing topical comedy, obviously it's gone, it's transient, it's kind of chewing gum in some ways, but you know, things, certain names and people will and stories will change. So when I'm doing a tour, I kind of try and think about, I'm going to be doing this in 9 months from now. So I will talk about the time I met Mary McAllen. I will talk about my dad. No. I'll talk about my car or whatever. Something that will last for 9 or 10 months, you know. But the stories, no, I kind of still find the same silly things funny.
I love, but the thing you do in the North, I love the blame game with Tim McGarry. He's funny. Tell me the time going to the...
McGarry, yeah. Myself and McGarry went to the Champions League final. He got me very posh tickets. And so we went to Liverpool, Real Madrid, and that was the one where they were tear gassing people. So the tear gas people, and it was coming towards us, French police. They were not very pleasant at all. And but they had forgotten that Tim McGarry grew up in North Belfast in the 70s. McGarry laughed in their face, pretty much. Like, we all had tears in our eyes, I said to him, but his were from nostalgia. So I'm like just like a soft southerner going, what's going on? He's like, it's just a wee bit of atmosphere. It's just a wee bit of atmosphere. Because the RUC used to call this Republican incense. So he was kind of unperturbed by the whole thing. Like, we walk around the corner and there's a French copper and he has this kind of thing that fires them. And Tim's like, keep your elbow tucked in now and aim it high. He was just completely undisturbed by the whole thing. And I was kind of freaking out a bit. But McGarry is my guiding light sometimes. So I've done a lot of work in the North. So I can kind of, most of the time, he says, touch wood, you know, you walk through the vagaries of it. Yeah. And if there's anything, I go, is that the right reference? He goes, yeah, that's the right reference. So every so often I'll check something with him, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, because Northern humour, do you think it's different to what? Yeah.
Next question.
Like,
I do not recognise the rank of the person who asked me the question. I think it's slightly darker. I think Belfast is slightly darker for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Because comedians love that.
Yeah.
Because comedians tend to have dark sense of humour because they've seen everything. So I do like this little bit of an edge in Belfast. So I absolutely love Belfast. Like,
I always think it's nice about lots of you Irish comedians. They're very collegiate, aren't they? Like, I know you're competitive, but you do seem to be actually quite supportive of each other.
Yeah, once you do well. they're very collegiate. Sure, how would they not be? Aren't they? Sure, they're flying. It's nice and easy to be gracious when you're absolutely flying. Ah, no, it is. It's a broadly supportive thing. But I think it's probably like, say there's 80 comedians in Ireland. It's like any workplace with 80 people in it, you know.
Yeah.
You've got 5 people you don't get on with. You've got 70 people you really, you know, really get on with. And then there's 5 really good mates that you grew up with and work together with. And like Bernard O'Shea would have been one of my... I remember giving Bernard a lift back from gigs and my mother's little red starlet and him going, I'm joining the guards. I'm, you know, so two of us would have died at some gig somewhere. I'm joining the guards. And I'm like, it's fine for you. I'm not tall enough to join the guards. You can join the guards. And he came from a long line of guards and he goes, I'll get you in. I said, you can't get me in. So we have been through the wars.
Well, thank you for joining me this morning for this look back at 2024 and some of the conversations I really enjoyed with my guests. We'll be back on air next Sunday morning. Today's programme was produced by the series producer Deirdre Neeline and Elaine Conlon was our broadcast coordinator. I'll leave you this morning with a song from Amble, who came into play for us in Studio 8. This is Mariner Boy.
Saving my flowers away for you, though it's homeward I know I should be. Summer's gone and the birds they've flown on the winds of the migrating seas, on the winds of the migrating seas.